This is Jacqueline Lukman with the Real News Network. Many people believe they have seen evidence of the full-blown fascism that they were afraid of from the Trump administration as the events of the failed insurrection on the U.S. Capitol unfolded on January 6th. And make no mistake, the Trump supporters who stormed the Capitol building were indeed fascists. They were among them, as evidenced by the fascist flags, slogans on T-shirts, and the very act of attempting to violently change the outcome of an election. The flags and sweatshirt slogans are particularly jarring for people as they evoke images of the type of fascism that Americans are most familiar with, the overtly racist and genocidal regime of Adolf Hitler and Nazism. But these symbols of what is ultimately a European-centered reflection of fascism narrow the concept of fascism and excludes other aspects of it that are very important in understanding what fascism really is and what it means to those of us who think we do not live in a fascist state. We're here to unpack the need to decenter Europe in the discussion about fascism is Ajamu Baraka. Ajamu is the national organizer for the Black Alliance for Peace, an organization I must disclose to you that I am a member of and proud to be a member of. So Ajamu, welcome and thank you so much for joining me for this discussion.
It is my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So let's dig into this because, you know, while I don't disagree that the insurrection on January 6th was a fascist attack on the Capitol, I think it was, I also think that our belief that fascism is a European construct causes us to not see some aspects of fascism in other administrations before and, yes, after Trump. And you spoke about this at a recent event for the Black is Back Coalition about how fascism isn't really a European construct at all. So I want to start with how we understand fascism and the connections to Mussolini and Hitler that shape how we see fascism in the first place.
Well, yes, I think that's an important place to start. And in your opening comment, you also reflected on what is the popular understanding of fascism. And that popular understanding comes out of the experiences of Europe. And the activities leading up to the Second World War, activities and political developments coming out of Italy and then Nazi Germany. But, you know, when you look at how what we refer to as fascism, which is basically the terroristic coordination of the of a society and an economy by a dominant class in support of the capitalist rulers, then one has to go beyond the experiences in Europe. And we say that because, Jacqueline, the kind of authoritarianism, totalitarianism, vicious violence, that we associate with European fascism. Many of us argue that what people refer to as fascism in Europe is really the colonial practices that Europeans use to establish themselves and to provide the material basis for the creation of Western Europe and the U.S., that those were the practices that emanated from the invasion of the Americas, and that those practices were then re-imported, if you will, into Europe in the late 1920s and 1930s. And so it becomes almost like fascism becomes what white people do to other white people, as opposed to the kind of fascistic practices that we saw with the colonial project and the continuation of the colonial project. So we say that you can't understand so-called fascism without understanding or at least looking at colonialism, looking at the methods that were used by these European states to establish themselves, looking at The U.S., for example, and looking at the end of the Civil War, and one raises the questions, how can you define the political makeup in post-Civil War U.S. in the South, especially after the end of so-called Reconstruction? How can you characterize that as anything but fascism? You had a one-party state, Democrats, in alignment with Northern capital and the local bourgeoisie, denying democracy and the and basic humanity to African people in the South, yeah, an apartheid system. So basically, one has to expand one's understanding of so-called fascism to understand that those practices are historically determined, and that one has to be able to decipher the particularities of what we might define as fascism at any historical moment. And that's why it's important to understand that the fascism that we are facing today, I think, in the U.S., has to be understood as going beyond just the easy understanding of fascism associated with Donald Trump.
Now, you made a very interesting point that I want to go back to and expand on a little bit when you talked about the post Reconstruction South in particular being under a one-party state. It was a fascist state. It was a one-party state. And you pointed out that it was the Democrats. And this is, you know, Ajamu, a point that Republicans today always point to when they talk about which party is more amenable to equality and justice for Black people in this country in particular. They always point to the roots of racist policies that the Democratic Party had in the South. And I'm wondering if you can expand on that a little bit, the idea that that is a false narrative. It is almost a distraction when one party today points to another political party from, you know, another period in time in this country's history, and what that means in this discourse about fascism and who is and is not fascist in this country. What is the tension between focusing on the Democratic Party as the fascist party in the post-reconstructed Reconstruction South coming from the Republican Party of today?
Well, you know, it's a very interesting question because, I mean, the fact of the matter is that the rhetoric being used by the Republicans to characterize the Democrats as the party, the non-progressive party in the post-Civil War period is an objective fact, that it was the Democrats that controlled the South. It was the Democrats that had the major investment in the upholding of white supremacy in the South. It was the Democrats under the so-called Dixiecrats that maintained that control into the 20th century. And in fact, the Dixiecrats were part of the new Democrat Party alignment that occurred in the 1930s that brought Roosevelt to power and maintained his power during that period. So, you know, the Republicans were the progressive party, but of course, what we see in the U.S. is how parties can shift in their emphasis, in their class bases. And so we've seen a very interesting evolution over the last 50 years that as a consequence of trying to maintain that alignment within the Democratic Party with the Dixiecrats, but also having to respond to the demands coming from another significant part of that alignment, which were and are African people or Black people, the Democrats were forced to respond to the demands of the mass movement and to get behind certain kind of legislative thrusts like the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act of 1964 and 1965. And so in as a consequence, that of course shifted the allegiance of many whites from the Democrats, in particular in the South, but really across the country, to the Republicans. And in fact, the Republicans used that shift as part of their strategy for regaining power in 1968. Under Richard Nixon. So the Southern strategy was part of what they deployed. And we've seen that shift continue ever since. Today, we see that the Republican Party has shifted dramatically to the right. And as a consequence, we see a realignment even among the Democrats. But going back to this notion of what this means around the issue of fascism is this. With the incorporation of these racist types that sort of correspond to the ideal of what a racist looks like, you know, the pot-bellied, you know, tobacco chewing, you know, Southern kind of white person, and now the militia with their, you know, camouflage fatigues and all of that, you know, and shouting irrationalities into the wind. You know, of course, these images are associated with this element within the Republican Party. But what is dangerous about that, Jacqueline, is this, that this emergence of elite economic power with the state and with the shrinking of democracy, this is occurring among Democrats and under Democrat Party regimes. So while we are fixated on the theatrics of the Trump folks and those forces, we are missing the more subtle and more insidious moves being made by the neoliberal economic elite operating through the Democrat Party to constrain and constrict Democratic participation, to camouflage their class program, which is an anti-democratic program and a pro-war program. And so some of us are saying, folks, let's understand what fascism looks like at various historical moments. And while you might embrace these efforts on the part of big tech in alignment and part of the Democrat Party coalition, you know, pretending like they're concerned about white supremacists and engaging in massive censorship, remember that the real target is the left, because the real target are those elements that are opposed to capitalism, not the far right that will align itself with capitalism under the guise of a patriotic bourgeoisie or a patriotic capitalism. You know, so we are trying to help people to understand, you know, the full sophistication of this moment and be on guard, and even in some ways being more on guard with the efforts of the neoliberal right that is in power, that's never relinquished power, even under Donald Trump, that we've got to be watching all of these elements if we're going to be able to avoid a more developed fascism that would be even more insidious and more difficult to reverse than the kind of fascism associated with the Democrat, with the Trump forces.
And you mentioned a word, Ajamu, that I think people are becoming more familiar with, but I think are still kind of unclear on, and that is neoliberalism. I think people are becoming more familiar with neoliberalism and the policies associated with it that negatively affect people's ability to survive under the austerity programs that they create and the like. But there are some people who support neoliberalism, you know, because the thinking is that, look, the market is a good thing. It's good for you. But as you pointed out, we can see fascism in neoliberal policies. And I'm wondering if you can help people understand where we can see those fascistic elements within neoliberal policies from either political party, because I think we're also very much fixated on which political party is either fascist or not fascist, or is more fascist or less fascist than the other.
Well, you know, that's a very good question, again, because to understand the neoliberal turn and the neoliberal stage of capitalism, one has to go back to the 1970s. And the 1970s was the decade of the counter-revolution and the counter-insurgency that was directed domestically within the U.S. against the Black Liberation Movement and against the progressive and radical movements in this country, but primarily directed against the Black Liberation Movement, because the Black Liberation Movement was, in fact, the driving force of radical politics in this country. Globally, though, one looks has to look at Chile and the coup that was engineered by the U.S. in that country, because in Chile, you had the first example of a fully developed neoliberal project that was engineered and directed by the folks from the Chicago School, the Milton Friedman and his boys, where they had an opportunity to apply all of their ideals about developing an economy that was free of any kind of state interventions that will put any kind of brake on the operation of capital, where labor would be fully disciplined, and where there would be no threat of any kind of popular participation or popular control, because you would eliminate democracy, basically. So you had the experiment in Chile internationally, and you had the counterinsurgency and counter-revolution in the U.S. It's not a mistake. It's not a coincidence that in the 1970s, you had the rise of the right. You had conservatism first represented by the administration of Jimmy Carter, and then by Ronald Reagan. And it was in the 1980s that the neoliberal project fully developed, where you know there was a move to take the state or the government out of any meaningful participation in the economy. It was basically a revolt against post-war Keynesianism that saw a role of the state in stimulating the economy. They believed that there had to be some support for organized labor. They believed there had to be some programs or projects of redistribution so that workers and others would be able to survive. With neoliberalism, all of those policies were gradually eliminated, culminating, for example, with Bill Clinton and the elimination of welfare as we knew it. So this taking the government out of the economy, of opening up the economy for the full-blown plundering by capital, this is part of the neoliberal project, making everything a commodity. All of the services that we normally associated with the government, with the state, then are privatized. So this is the project that represents the emergence of capital and the state, the full control of the state by capital, including moves to undermine the limited democracy that did exist in the U.S. So these are this is the reality we've been dealing with since the 1980s and 1990s. And they are just culminating with the election of a Donald Trump, with the more extremist expressions of some elements of that kind of neo-liberalism. With the elimination now of Donald Trump, we're seeing a return to a full-blown commitment to neoliberal policies. Remember now, part of the opposition to Donald Trump on the part of the ruling elite was that they believe he might undermine the carefully constructed architecture of the neoliberal international order by his rhetoric being committed to, theoretically, to the working class and all of that. So, you know, this is what we are dealing with today in terms of understanding what neoliberalism is and how it relates to neo-fascism.
And I cannot help but ask, Ajamo, about the Biden administration and its, I don't know, positioning in this continuing neo-fascist expression in this country, and not just in this country, but around the world. But I'm thinking particularly of social media, because we are in the midst of this pandemic and almost everything we are doing is being done on social media and technology platforms. We are meeting apparatuses, or however you say it, through these mediums, through these technology mediums. that are controlled by massive corporations that are unregulated, and they are able, with the government's consent under the Biden administration, to control people's speech on their platforms. Is this a form of fascism, controlling dissent, as it were? If people understand that this is what the Nazi Party did in Germany by destroying independent press and jailing journalists and those who dissented against them, is this not the censorship that we're seeing in social media, in technology? Is this not a type of fascism that's going on now under the so-called liberal Biden administration?
This is what I referred to earlier in terms of the totalitarian moves being made by big tech, by these forces aligned with the Democrat Party. And the danger of us not recognizing how these moves are in fact resulting in constricting democratic participation, the free flow of information and analysis. Under the guise of being concerned about fascism, we have embraced policies that are in fact facilitating a fascistic control and organization of society. These attempts to try to impose an ideological conformity on the population are now becoming normalized. And that is the a textbook definition of a fascistic society. So yes, these are the challenges we have to be aware of, because until we are aware of those, then we're not going to be able to resist. And we won't see the kinds of moves that are being made both domestically and internationally that we need to oppose. Not only do we have to look at this issue of censorship, Jacqueline, but the kind of commitment to lawlessness that we've seen under the regimes within the U.S. over the last 40 years is another example of the trajectory of right-wing politics in this country. The fact that the U.S. no longer even bothers to try to mask their interventions under the guise of international law or through the UN. Now they engage in rogue state type activities basically to pursue and advance their own particular national interests. And this is all part of what we are seeing as the global expressions of a neoliberal fascistic politics today. So we've got to be aware of all of the manifestations of the neoliberal order, because the international ruling class that is at the base of this, they're quite serious about maintaining their global power. And we've got to be aware of that and understand all of the methods that are being employed to try to, in fact, do that.
So, Ajamu, for people who are at the end of this discussion we're having now and asking, so which way do I turn? Do I turn? Is the answer in the Republican Party? Is the answer in the Democratic Party? Is the answer in the United States government? Where is the answer for people who are now concerned that, yes, we do live in a fascist state, but don't know what to do about it? What's your answer to them for what do they do about what they now know?
Well, what they have to do is understand that we have to have a movement for democracy, for real participatory democracy in this country, one. Secondly, we have to recognize that our interests are fundamentally opposed to the interests of the capitalist class, the 1%. And we have to recognize, too, that the way in which the 1% is able to maintain this is hegemony is by working with and working through the 20%, that element of the middle class or what we call the petty bourgeoisie that's politically and ideologically in alignment with the capitalist class. So we have to understand the terms of struggle and not be demoralized by the fact that we have such a formidable opponent. So understanding these relationships, being committed to joining organizations to oppose this relationship, demanding that this government, until we change it, respond to the objective human rights needs of the people, demanding that the tax breaks for the wealthy are reversed, that the money being squandered for military expenditures of over $1 trillion are rediverted to address human needs, demanding that the governments, both at the national, state, and local levels, reflect the interests of the vast majority of the people who are, in fact, working class people. So what we have to have in the U.S. is a movement for democracy and a movement toward getting rid of the capitalist project, because it's quite clear from Colvin that capitalism is unable to protect us and unable to provide for our material needs. So we've got to recognize, without radical fundamental change in this country, we are going to continue to see the kind of ravages we see so far with the ruling, with the working class, and the kind of suffering that we see across this country, graphically revealed by the COVID pandemic. So we need a revolutionary change in this country. We need to be striving for and developing a uniquely U.S.-centered kind of socialist project. Without socialism, without eliminating this backward capitalist project, the suffering will continue.
And if people want to get connected with you and learn more about Black Alliance for Peace, one of those organizations that I believe people can learn deep information, get deep political education on these issues from, how can they connect with the organization?
We say, please come to blackallianceforpeace.com. If you are an African, you can join this organization as a member. If you are a non-African, meaning non-Black person, you can still join as a supporter. We have a solidarity network that's growing every day. These are people who are in alignment with our vision and our values. We are about building a new kind of society. And to do that, we have to have organization. So we say to everyone, if you want to see the possibility of a new society in a new world, get into an organization, support the Black Alliance for Peace or some other organization like this, and let's remember that we are, in fact, the majority and that we, in fact, can win. But we have to be organized and clear with our political project, which has to be a project going toward a socialist transformation.
Well, Ajaan Mubaraka, I thank you so much for taking the time to help us unpack this issue of fascism, what it really is, and to truly help us decenter the European expression of fascism, to help us understand that we are indeed living in a fascist state right here in the good old United Snakes of America. So I appreciate you, Ajamu. Thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And as always, friends, thank you for watching. This is Jacqueline Lukman with the Real News Network in the belly of the beast, Washington, D.C.